In 2014, a group of gunmen entered a school in the little village of Chibok in northern Nigeria. The gunmen were part of an Islamist organisation known as Boko Haram. And Boko Haram is a kind of a mishmash phrase. It roughly translates as Western education is forbidden, particularly the education of women and girls. There were fears that the girls would be enslaved or killed, and there was an international outcry. Michelle Obama lent her voice to the cause of finding them and releasing them. Stephen Davis was watching all this unfold on TV in Perth, where he lives. Like everyone else, he was terribly worried about the schoolgirls. So Stephen Davis picked up his phone and he called the Boko Haram commanders. He actually knew some of these men because Stephen had served as an advisor to several presidents of Nigeria. And in that role, he'd already met with the leaders of Boko Haram. Stephen Davis has worked for Western Mining Corporation and as a consultant for the petroleum giant Shell. His primary role was as a negotiator in the field of conflict resolution. And so he went back to Nigeria to see if any rescue was possible. Hello, Stephen.
Richard, thank you.
Is that how you see yourself, as a negotiator? Is that primarily what you do?
No, that's sort of just things that seem to happen to me. Life rolls along and just happen to be in the, if you like, the, it's either the right place at the right time or the wrong place at the right time. It depends on your view.
When you walk into situations where you're meeting people who are often of hostile intent for the very first time, what do you do? Is there something about your body language you would do when you approach such people? Is there a certain way you like to approach people to indicate that you're ready to listen and that something might be achieved by you talking to them?
I'm always very honest. Never tell a fib. I think I'm very open with them. It's always been a case of virtually a cross-cultural situation. The first encounters usually are, you're American, I'm going to shoot you. And so I found it's been awfully helpful to be Australian. Yeah, Australia seems to still carry this neutrality, or even better than that, a very positive view. I think the first time in the Niger Delta, when I went to a rebel camp, the senior commander of the protection group around the rebel leader stuck an AK-47 pretty close to my mouth and said, you're American, I'm going to shoot you. No, no. He said, oh, you're British, I'm still going to shoot you. No, no. I'm Australian.
That worked?
It did. It did. I'm Australian. But the most astonishing thing was he then said, ah, Crocodile Dundee. And everything was okay thereafter. An astonishing change. And so I found being very open and being Australian has helped enormously.
What were your plans when you left school, Stephen?
I went to uni like everybody else because that's what you did, only I didn't know why. So it was very lacklustre at university. It was no real interest. I had a job in the school holidays on drilling rigs in outback New South Wales. Went back to uni in the second year, changed courses, no real interest. So I went back to drilling, working in the outback, where I realised the money I was getting on the drilling rigs was better than had I graduated in psychology.
Still, you studied teaching for a while, didn't you?
That was some years later. I had an encounter in far north Queensland, out of Chiligo, the Jack and Newell's General Store, where everything in town was there. Working in one day with one of the other drillers, an Aboriginal fellow sitting outside the window on the veranda. And as the guy in front of me, a local pastor, walked in, he spat on the Aboriginal guy. I was absolutely rooted to the spot. I couldn't believe what I had just seen. I was astonished that one human being could do this to another. And I think that was the turning point. I'd worked with a few Aboriginal chaps thereafter on the drilling rigs, but I did come to see what I thought was terrible treatment of Aboriginal people in many outback towns, and so I applied for a scholarship to teach Aboriginal children in the outback.
So you and your wife, Julie, went out to teach Indigenous kids, at a place called Crocodile Islands.
Yeah.
I've never heard of the Crocodile Islands. Whereabouts are the Crocodile Islands? And that does it does sound like a pirate's, you know, island, doesn't it? And, you know.
Well, it does. The group, the Crocodile Islands group, is sort of two-thirds away across the Arnhem Land coast between Darwin and Gove. We were on Crocodile Island, which was the largest of the Crocodile Island group. It's 5 kilometres by three. And it's basically an island of sand in the middle and mangroves around the outside.
Right.
Lots of mosquitoes and lots of crocodiles.
What was teaching there like?
Teaching was I was accused of wandering aimlessly in the community. I found that when we started school, the children weren't coming to school. There was no connect between school and Aboriginal life. So I went down to the camp where there were several tribes living along the edge of the beach and sought to find out what would these young people, and I had young men, basically. It was high school, although there wasn't a high school, high school age. What would they be doing if they weren't at school? And I basically took school back into the community. So I went out each day with the parents and the kids and whatever they were doing, and it was hunting and fishing every day. Got to the stage where here was the catch, here was what they had gathered, bring it back into the classroom and get the old people to describe it and use that as a subject for writing, for maths, and this started to build up. And until we had so many children in the school, we didn't have a classroom. So the next stage was, okay, these young guys, we'll show them how to build a classroom. And so with the older boys, we built a classroom. That was done. And the next thing, fishing started. So we salvaged an old boat. And the guys learned a lot of skills on rebuilding the boat, an outboard motor. There was an old net. The older ladies were very good at basket weaving, and they could remember the days when they used to weave nets to catch fish. So we got the old ladies working on this net. We had a barramundi net, an 18-foot boat with a 2-horsepower motor, and off we went. And the old men agreed to send one man who was an expert at fishing and fish habits to guide us, and we started catching fish, and then we sold it back to the local store. So here was commercial transactions. We're trying to find. There was no employment on the island, so what are all the skills these guys would need to run the community, look after their families in as life went on? So we simply built school around all those sorts of things.
It sounds like you're able to develop an educational system that sort of travelled alongside traditional practices and did not disrupt traditional lines of authority in the place. It was an alternative to the learning of the elders in that community.
If you teach Aboriginal, say Aboriginal children, Aboriginal boys, in that particular language, there was no way to ask why. You could ask roughly the translation for what reason does something exist, because a boy couldn't ask why. You are told information that you need to know at the time that you need to know it. And then after your first initiation, you are told a new batch of information, second initiation, and so it goes. The way a child learned was by walking through the mangroves or fishing every day, and as they walked along, someone would just point at a tree and say its name. And it was situation-specific, the learning, totally different. When you suddenly teach a child how to learn, and if these days if you give it access to Wikipedia, the whole structure, as you said, you're absolutely right, you destroy the traditional structure of authority because the child is no longer subject to the authority of the older person being taught when to know this information or that. And so, if you like, in doing the right thing in providing education to Aboriginal children in the bush, we've actually inadvertently destroyed the social structure and the lines of authority.
This fishing school that you'd set up, did you ever catch a croc?
We had a crocodile, a very healthy crocodile. The idea is you'd go out and set the nets, and then you would come back each half tide as the tide ran out and as the tide went. Take out, we were fishing barramundi. So we had a 4-inch square barramundi net. Mind you, we did have a commercial fishing license. So it was all above board, and you'd set the net and come and clear it on the half tide run out, half tide on the run in. If you didn't, the fish would stay too long in there. The scent of the fish would be picked up by the crocs or the sharks, and they would tear the net apart. This particular morning, early morning, I had the boat full of boys. We were going to clear the net, get the fish, bring it in to the shop before we went to school. So this was all extracurricular activity. And as we got closer, where we'd set the net about 7 or 8 kilometres away near the mainland, here was an enormous crocodile sitting there. And
in the net?
While he was next to the net,
right,
with his jaws up on a big barramundi in the net. Whoa, this was pandemonium. What are we going to do? We edged closer and closer. It took quite a long while until we realised the croc was dead. He must have come and taken the barra, about a 35-pound barramundi, on the rising tide, had his incisor teeth, as he rolled, caught in the net, and had drowned. The tide had gone out, and here we are on the outgoing tide. So to us, he looked like this guy's alive.
Right, it's still right, because the jaws are still open.
Ah, yeah.
So what do you do now with a dead croc on your hands?
Well, the problem was a crocodile was a very, 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 very sacred totem for the people there. And one of the tribes, their major totem was a crocodile. So, well, we had a problem. We couldn't just leave it there. There would be hell to pay back in camp later. So with a lot of grunting, well, a hell of a lot of grunting, we got this croc up beside the boat. We couldn't get it in the boat. It was too big. Although the boat was 18 feet long, it was just too heavy to get in. So we strapped it to the side of the boat and made our way back with our little 2-horsepower motor back to the beach where we'd lived. And we anchored offshore. And we had to go in and clear up with the elders what's the protocol here.
And what was the protocol?
The protocol was a lot of talking between the heads of the various tribes. And in the end, they said, okay, here's the story. We will be able to eat this crocodile. Special circumstances. They can always find a way around these sorts of things. But I would have to butcher the crocodile. They couldn't do it because it's a very, very, very sacred animal. Right. They could not do this.
Yeah, this is your problem, buddy.
This is my problem. Right. Well, and years before, I used to butcher sheep. We had our own sheep. We used to butcher. But, okay.
I'm so looking at this from a very modern 21st century perspective. Like if I'd been handed a knife and said, go out there and butcher that crocodile, I'd be a little... I'd have some trepidation, I think.
Which side do you start? Underside or other side? Do I peel it open from the back or peel it open from the belly?
Look, I wouldn't know. I wouldn't know.
Well, I thought about it, and then I thought about handbags. And I thought, what are they? Do they save the underbelly? So I had to ring the Conservation Commission in the Northern Territory because crocodiles are protected. You're not allowed to kill a crocodile unless you're Aboriginal. There was one phone on the island. I rang the Conservation Commission and explained the situation. I don't know. There's a bit of consultation. I said, okay, we understand it's drowned. You can butcher the crocodile. However, there's some information that we require. We would like to know the length of the crocodile, the girth of the crocodile, right, the width of the jaws, and its sex. I was good for three. The fourth one was a problem. I'd never sexed a crocodile previously.
How do you determine the gender of a crocodile?
That's exactly what I asked.
Right.
I said, give me a clue. And the guy said, well, look. He asked me how long it was. I told him it was a 14-footer. He said, okay. Well, what you do is you get under the crocodile and you stick your hand up its vent, as you do. Then he said, well, you forage around. And if it's a male, it'll feel like a cricket bat handle. And if you can't find it, it's a female. Okay. So
oh dear.
I went back down to the beach. Julie's there. My wife was there. And I think every Aboriginal inhabitant on the island had turned out to watch this. So we've got this.
It's pretty good entertainment, isn't it?
Well, the croc is nosed onto the beach. And I tried to explain to the older men as best I could what I had to do. And I could see the puzzled look on their faces when I got to point number 4. I said, oh, don't worry about it. Oh, it's okay. And so we measured the croc. Then we got to the sexing part. So I knelt down in the shallow water next to the croc and got the guys to sort of tilt it on its side. and proceeded to investigate. And I, as you know, hands in, and then out past the wrist, and it's getting further and foraging around further, and leaning against the side of the crocodile, I vividly remember, oh, foraging, red hot day, so hot, perspiring. I sort of open my eyes to realise there's 300 people here, all watching me, wondering, what do white men do? Do they? What's the go? Anyway, so I wrote it off as a female.
Right.
Decided not to investigate further, and then proceeded with butchering the crocodile.
If it were me, I would have used a different set of criteria. I would have gone around the front, and if it had long eyelashes, I would have said it was a lady. That's what I would have done. And it was to know any better, anyway.
Very good. I should have thought of that.
So how do you make the jump then from teaching on Crocodile Island to becoming a consultant for Shell Oil?
Well, I spent enough time with the Aboriginal older men to have, well, be reasonably conversant in the language and learn enough about fish species, their habitats, traditional knowledge of the sea. And so when the first sea claim came along, like land claims, the first sea claim, I initially was called by the judge, Justice Toohey, to interpret, and eventually ended up giving evidence, and the case was won by the local Aboriginal people. And so the next one happened, and I ended up in the same position there, putting that case together. Then the Tiwi people, Bathurst and Melville Islands, heard about it and asked me to come and help over there, and things sort of went on and went on. And out of that, we'd won enough cases that the Chief Minister of the Northern Territory decided to call it quits, and they would not contest the cases. So it was a case of being able to then negotiate a management agreement of the seas with the Northern Territory government, something that was allow the commercial fishing industry to work, but also protect particular inshore places that were important to Aboriginal people.
So did that catch Shell's eye, did it? The idea that you could go into places and do these kind of things?
What had happened, I ended up working in Western Mining because at that stage, the CEO of Western Mining could see that these encounters with Aboriginal people in Australia would become critical. In other words, the oil, gas and mineral industry had been through the environment phase. They didn't know how to deal with that, and there were so many bun fights. But WMC, Hugh Morgan, can see the next ground is going to be social issues, the social license to operate. And Western Mining were the largest landholders in Australia, so there was a lot of potential for problems. I ran some courses for their people, as I had been doing for the police, on working with Aboriginal people and, if you like, cross-cultural training. And that's basically how I earned some money as a consultant. But WMC wanted to get really serious about it. And I was offered a job there, which I refused. So I was offered a job again, and I refused. And the third time round, Julie and I talked about it a lot, and I thought there's an opportunity to change the minerals industry. So I worked in WMC on the executive group, reviewing all of these situations that they had all over the world with Indigenous people, and positioning the company a lot better and accommodating local issues. And that's how I ended up with Shell, because through WMC, I was the chairman of a group called Business Partners for Development, the largest oil, gas and mineral companies of the world. And we'd meet every 6 months, a group of us, to work through the critical social problems that were facing projects around the world. But the one company that would never reveal the detail of a situation they would bring before us repeatedly, the Niger Delta, was Shell. They simply would not disclose the information to the other companies. And then it might have been 2001, I think, or early 2002, I had a phone call from Shell in The Hague and said, would you be the independent expert to join an internal group to review the Niger Delta? And I thought, I'd love to know what you've been hiding. And I said yes. And that's how I ended up going to Nigeria consulting to Shell.
Now, as you say, they had probably self-interestedly good reason to conceal what they've been doing in the Niger Delta. The story that's often told about Shell in Nigeria is that when they first arrived in the 1950s, they brought a lot of economic growth, a lot of productivity into the Nigerian economy. But increasingly, there'd been a whole string of environmental catastrophes. The company had stood in the way of democratization, implicitly been involved in the disappearance of political rivals, become involved in a kind of moral and social and political and environmental quagmire over there. Once you went over there, what kind of things were you seeing?
Well, I think what you just described is absolutely spot on. 1995, I recall listening to the news and Ken Sarawiwa, I think 8 Ogoni men had been executed because they were basically protesters protesting about Shell's treatment of the Ogoni people in the Niger Delta. It was interesting to be inside Shell in latter years and talk through people involved in it, and it was clear that Shell were putting a lot of pressure on the government to stop Ken Sarawiwa and others. But the pressure was such that the government have actually did something, and I think my view is that Shell realised too late that the government had not only nabbed these guys, was about to execute them, and too late, and it had all gone pear-shaped. One of the guys who was locked up with the guys to be executed and was released the night before by mistake, I spent a lot of time with him, but he was on the run and hiding from the government for years. But Shell, so what were they hiding from? Well, one was having access to the oil. And when we went, when I went as part of the Shell group to review all the operations there, it was an environmental mess. Christmas trees, a wellhead called a Christmas tree, there were Christmas trees there were just leaking oil everywhere. Kids were walking through communities, villages, like they had a pair of black socks on because the soil was just soaked with oil. And of course, each family has a little plot to live on in that tribal area. You can't move to another tribal area and take your land there, so it's an inheritance, if you like. And if you couldn't make a living out of that, you were in dire straits. So oil-soaked land, there were areas where fires because of the oil burning. And, well, I'll put it this way, 30 days and 30 nights I was there with the Shell team. The guy who was the head of the team was the head of external relations worldwide for Shell. And on that last day, we were in a newly built village. Shell had built the village. Why? Because in the background was an LNG plant. They'd moved these people off their village area, traditional area, built them a new village so they could use the area for an LNG plant. And we stopped the little mini bus we were in, and we were looking at this village as an example of best practice. It was a drizzly, rainy day. The sewage drains that ran around the outskirts of the village, right next to the bus, there were two young girls squatting down next to the drain, which was almost overflowing. As the sewage went by, so they were washing the plates, the dinner plates.
In the sewage?
You got it. And then the fellow who's leading the group, standing there in the middle of the road, and began to weep. And he said, I've never worked for anyone all my life, anyone else but this company all my life, he said, and I never dreamed we were responsible for things like this.
And once you wrote the report, was Shell interested in it or ready to act on it?
Well, I give it to the managing director of Shell in Nigeria was keen to do something about it, but that's not what Shell headquarters worldwide. They wanted to bury it. And, of course, I think the question was, would this have a material impact on Shell's share price? Should it be released to the stock exchange? Well, in the end, one of the team that did the report leaked it to the media, and that set the hair running. The MD in Shell in Nigeria, he really wanted to change the situation. I don't think he had the support from The Hague at that stage. I went back maybe 5 or 6 times. I would get back to Perth. I'd get a call from him. He'd say, look, come back, help me, I want to do X, Y, Z. And they were right in many ways. They knew how to find oil and gas, and they knew how to pump oil. But it was very similar to Western mining, but they didn't know how to handle the social issues. It was not their forte. NGOs who knew how to do this wouldn't help because this was the enemy. This was the sort of the battle lines, the old battle lines between companies and environmental groups. Now we're having new battle lines between companies and, if you like, social advocacy groups. And I suppose we go back to something you'd said earlier in the piece about negotiating. I think my role was in very much, well, hang on, the companies don't know how to do this. If you're going to make a change, you need to help them change. So it was a case of getting the NGOs to start working with these guys. Can't work with the enemy. Well, you're always going to have an enemy, but if they need help and you refuse, the time comes when you are also responsible. And in time, a number of NGOs started to work with a plan and we started to make things come together.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio.
You were brought in to deal with a conflict between the Nigerian government and some rebels in the Niger River Delta. What did the rebels want in this case? What was this fight about?
Shell, this was the case in many African nations where one big company ran the show and almost ran the government for years. Military dictatorships. 1999, President Obasanjo, a military general, had ushered in democracy. The country started to open up to the media. And if you like, the hottest location was Bayelsa State, a newly created state, which was where oil was first discovered in the 1950s. This was the most lucrative area. But the vast wealth being paid to the government wasn't going back to the communities, almost nothing. So after 50 years of Shell's presence in Bayelsa State and these communities, there was nothing to show, there were no benefits. I was going to say there was nothing to show Shell was ever there. There was. There were oil slicks on fresh water everywhere. Huh. The government are receiving huge amounts of money. So in Nigeria at that stage, no one's paying taxes. You didn't need to. The whole country floats on oil. What this led to, of course, was massive corruption and fabulously wealthy people, a very tiny proportion at the top. But there was simply no evidence in these Niger Delta communities, the source of the oil, no evidence of any benefit to these communities. And in the end, I think Ken Sarawira and the protests of the Ogonian, they were always peaceful protests, unarmed. But in Bayelsa State, the Ijaw tribe simply wouldn't take it anymore. And that led to the rebel activity.
So you couldn't solve these problems with Shell until you reached a ceasefire with these rebels, in other words.
Well, I put together a program of community sustainable community development that would bring about a sustained positive change in the lives of the indigenous people in the Niger Delta.
So how would
you get it off the ground, though, because of the conflict. So I resolved to go and get the guys to surrender.
How did you do that?
Wars don't go on forever. Conflicts don't go on forever. Not only do the communities become conflict fatigued, the government becomes conflict fatigued, the rebels become conflict fatigued. And if you can monitor that well enough and recognize the signals, see the signs of conflict fatigue, what commonly happens is everyone wants to end it, but they don't know how.
So there's a window of opportunity that someone has to crawl through, and that's you,
well,
isn't it?
It is, but who do you trust? Mm. No one would trust anyone on either side, but here was I had no part to play in anything. So I spoke to a friend, a Nigerian friend. I said, why don't we get the guys to surrender? We talked about back and forth. He said, are you really serious? I said, sure, why not? How would you do it? I said, well, we'll go and meet Asari, the leader, put a deal to him, and if he likes it, he comes aboard, we'll go and see the president. He said, but how are you going to do all this? I don't know, we'll figure out something. And he said, oh, well, anyway, he excused himself. He came back 5 minutes later and he said, yeah, Asari will meet with you. He had called him. He was also Ijaw tribe. Through a friend of a friend, he could find the guy on a phone, called him, and said, the guy will meet with you. On the following, that was a Saturday morning, on the Tuesday,
I'd set up a deal with a friend that if I didn't come back, Julie had a ticket to get out, and this friend would get her on the plane and works. We had, if you like, an exit strategy.
Right. Worst case scenario stuff.
Yes. Things went pear-shaped. Here's how it works. So I was picked up early in the morning, and my friend and I, the Nigerian chap, we were then taken to a particular place and dropped on a corner. We stood around looking stupid for a while until another car came by, picked us up. And then we went off and we dropped at a cafe. And then 5 minutes later, a guy comes in through the back of the cafe. We follow him out and we get in another car and off we go. So we played ducks and drakes all over the city.
This is a bit John McCarrey, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. That's right. And then we got into this clapped out vehicle with three other guys who were all rebel commanders. And in the boot, they had a load of AK-47s. And so off we went, heading out of town, and there are a number of military stops. And the idea was, I'm the white guy. This would help get us through the military stops. So as you slow down for the military, I would salute them. And, of course, they didn't know who I was. I must be some visiting senior military man.
Big wig.
Yep. So they would stand to attention and salute me, and we would roll on through the roadblock. And this happened two or three times. We got to the Delta and there was a speedboat waiting for us. And off we went to a little island where we then commandeered a dugout canoe. So my friend and I, and a packet of biscuits between us and a bottle of water, we paddled. Well, we actually, that's not right. We didn't paddle the canoe. Me, being the white man, I paddled the canoe and he ate the biscuits. And it went on until we got to another smaller island, and we were picked up in what's called a flying boat, and this were the rebel groups. They had a couple of 200 horsepower motors on the back of these things and a heavy machine gun mounted at the front, and they have six guys with AK-47s or light machine guns. In you get, black bag over your head, off you go. And we wound through the swamps for, I don't know, half an hour until we were dropped at another island. Another group picked us up. By nightfall, we had reached the rebel headquarters. And we started, well, this is where the first routine started, being, you're a white man, you're American, I'm going to shoot you. No, I'm Australian. Ah, Crocodile Dundee. Then we had the rant and the rave by the rebel leader. But it went on well into the night. We sat in the middle of a circle of probably 30 of his guys, heavily armed, to make sure I wasn't going to do anything wrong. He agreed to meet a week later. So we were dropped back in another village. We slept there the night and made our way back. A week later, went and did it again, met at a different location. He agreed generally to the terms of not a surrender. It was a peace accord, like the Biafran War. Right. No victor, no vanquished. Yeah. Peace with honour.
Right, peace with honour for both sides.
Absolutely, that's right. I then, through a friend, was able to make a contact with President Obasanjo, and I went and saw him. He was a little taken aback that he was an offer for the guys to surrender, and I showed him some photographs. I had photos that night to prove that I had been with them, and he said, okay, I'll do the deal. And I was then shuffling back and forwards between the president in Abuja and the rebels down in the Niger Delta.
How do you actually then sign a peace accord? Do you have to bring them to Abuja, or do you bring government out to the rebels?
No. They had to come to Abuja, and this was the problem.
And did you have to bring them personally in?
I thought the president would just get the military to look after him. He said, No. No, they trust you. You're it. He said, Steve, you go down and bring them up. Bring them back up. So, Mr. President, you've got 70,000 people in your army, and you've got military intelligence and state security and national security. Don't you think there might be someone that you could use? So, no, you're the right man. This is good. I'll handle this myself.
Yeah, because you're neither fish nor fowl, are you? You don't belong to the military or to the rebels or anything. You're an outsider.
Yeah, so no one, I wasn't going to, if you like, double-cross anybody. So I said, I'd really like someone to go with me, someone you trust. And he came up with a guy who was an Ijaw guy, the same tribe as the rebels, and was, if you like, the equivalent of the Secret Service. He and four guys, two vehicles, they met me down there, and then we went by boat. And that night, it was midnight, we were to meet. on the edge of the swamps in a little village, and I was standing under a single light bulb, low wattage. It must have been 20 watts, you know, and it was a fine rain just coming down, and I'm standing against the wall, the glow of this thing. I could hear the boats, speedboats, going out in the darkness, and they're obviously going up and down, looking to see if there's any military or anyone else with me. After about an hour, the rebel leader, Asari, and his key commanders walked around the corner of the hut. We had to get to Port Harcourt Airport. The president was sending down the presidential jet. When we got to the other end of Abuja, we got off, and here were matching Mercedes waiting to take us. This is not right. There's something wrong with this. And they were ushering us in. No, 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 we have to get into this. We've been sent from the president. Rubbish. Anyway, I hailed a minibus, and all the rebel leaders and I jumped into the minibus, and off we went to see the president. These other guys had been sent by someone else to grab us. And in the end, we spent the day in the cabinet room where the rebel leaders virtually confessed all. The president asked them all about who assassinated who, what political assassinations, who contracted them, why they did it. The director of, if you like, the intelligence services was sitting there. There was another rebel leader who was coming the next day, and the president turned to the head of the secret intelligence services. Do you know where Ateki Tom is? Yes, sir, we have him in custody on a vessel offshore. Now, that wasn't true because I had someone with this man. And a passenger looked at me and I said, well, Mr. President, would you like me to call Ateki Tom and like to talk to him? He's not on the vessel. Oh, yes, please do, Steve. So I made a call. Our guy was standing with him and I said to Miyabia, do you have Ateki Tom with you? Yes, I do. Please hold his hand. What? He said, hold his hand and I want you to put the phone up for him to talk to. And he did, and we could hear his voice. And at that time, the president realized his head of the Secret Intelligence Service was playing his own game. And as we walked out of the offices 8 hours later, I was furious over this guy sending his guys to knock us off. And the president was just in front, one step in front. I'm walking next to the head of the Secret Intelligence Service, and I said, if you ever do something like that to me again, you won't live to see the sunrise the next day. I was furious about it. And he didn't know quite what to do. And I heard the president having a good chuckle. But this is the other thing that had worked for me from time to time. You're a European in an odd situation. You're the last thing they expect. And what it does create is a very brief window where everyone's caught unawares and they don't know quite what to do. You can do something constructive, but do not linger.
So let's fast forward to 2014 now, Stephen. You're at home back in Perth, Australia, living there with your wife, and the news story comes on. Boko Haram have entered a school in the northeast of Nigeria and abducted more than 200 schoolgirls. Why didn't you buy into the idea that these girls had just disappeared?
Well, when you think, okay, there were probably 220 girls. 50 got away before they were actually removed. To actually take over a pretty reasonable size small town, how many guys do you need? Plus, to ship 220 captives, how many vehicles do you need?
Oh, it's a large-scale operation, in other words, aren't you? Yeah.
And
it wouldn't go unnoticed, in other words.
Well, isn't that amazing? Yeah. It didn't even leave any wheel tracks, and not a person saw which way they went. Right. Thought, oh, come on. I just couldn't believe it, and it would go on and on. I thought, the next news break will tell us what really happened. The next news break never did really tell us what. This charade went on and on and on. And Julie and I kept talking about it. We just couldn't handle it. And in the end, I said, what about I ring some of the boys and see what the go is?
When you say the boys, who are the boys?
The Boko Haram commanders.
Right.
Well, we see, we'd had a peace deal twice. 2013, President Jonathan, I'd put together a peace deal, and we actually had 24 top commanders of Boko Haram all agree on it. Just took a lot of time, a lot of clandestine stuff. And the guys signed the peace deal. The president was willing to sign the peace deal. Others intervened. The peace deal was never consummated by the government. The Boko Haram leadership fled, and within 4 weeks, half of them had been assassinated. So we had a background where I knew the guys. So I made some phone calls.
So you're acting on your own initiative here from Perth, ringing up at these guerrilla leaders of Boko Haram in northern Nigeria somewhere from Perth. I know Australia doesn't have a kind of, so to speak, a dog in that fight. We don't have military forces on the ground. Do you need to ring DFAT to ask permission to do that kind of stuff?
I don't know. I did ring the Conservation Commission about cutting up a crocodile, but I never thought to ring DFAT about talking about her. Well, I must say that in all the time in Niger, whenever we did these things, a series of Australia's high commissioners, the guys were always terrific. No, you just do it. We have a son and three daughters. And I thought, if that was one of our girls that had been grabbed, you would turn yourself inside out and back to front.
Yes, you would.
Do anything. And yet, I've been to villages in the north that Boko Haram had been through, and they had taken every younger woman and every girl and every young boy. And the villagers got together and they decided some of the best men would go and retrieve the girls. Four or five men with bows and arrows, bare feet, are going to follow the wheel tracks of Boko Haram, and they're going to get their girls back. Now, Boko Haram, in 1 hour, travel as far as these guys could run night and day in 2 days. They were never going to see them again. It was a hopeless situation. And so when you hear 222 girls just got zapped out of there, and it's the most ridiculous thing because no one has an idea where they've gone. We just couldn't abide it.
So when she got on the phone to these leaders of Boko Haram, what did you put to them?
I know you were not involved because you would not do such a thing. Do you know who has the girls? Of course, sir. And so it goes with each of them. And so in quick succession, you try a few different ones so they haven't got a chance to ring each other. They know where they are. They know who's got them. Very reluctant to reveal at that distance and over a phone precise locations and the works. And all I was interested in was, can we get some of them back? Can we do a deal? Why they wanted them was not ransom at all initially. It was leverage over the government and basically to embarrass Good Luck Jonathan to show that a Christian president could not guarantee the security of even Christian schoolgirls.
But the reports I'd read was regarded that they were being used for slavery. They were being raped, married off
Chibok to... Chibok girls are just a tip of the iceberg there. Look, beforehand, by my estimate, there were at least 1,000 girls in the Boko Haram camps, the various camps around the place, had been kidnapped. They would traffic them for slavery. Slavery is alive and well through that sub-Saharan Africa.
So this means you go back to Nigeria?
Yeah, when I had... satisfied myself after talking to a few of the guys that there was a prospect of getting the girls. I actually did a deal on the phone. How many girls did we want? Oh, how much do they want for the girls? And they told me how much they wanted for each of the girls or what they'd been promised. Okay, well, I said, I'll match it. How many do you want, sir? I said, I want the lot. I will buy all the girls, all or nothing. Anyway, next day, some more calls, and that was agreed.
Where are you going to get the money?
Oh, well...
Your own money?
Wow, that's just the way things work out. I was on a plane the next morning. The press said that the president was doing nothing, but actually behind the scenes, he afforded me every logistical support I needed. He laid on a military aircraft for me. I went to the northeast, the capital there, and I had enough... former Boko Haram associates who had turned around and living the good life now, that a number of the guys were quite willing to help me. No one was paid for anything. Everyone wanted to do what they could do to fix this. But by this time, it had started to fracture and the girls had been split up into different camps. Ultimately, there were 6 Boko Haram camps, somewhere in Cameroon and Chad, 2 camps still in Nigeria. 18 girls were very ill. I said, I'll take the sick ones off your hands. You don't need them. They're slowing you down. I found if I could get 20 girls, what would then happen is the sponsors of Boko Haram would press the guys and they would go and hit some other villages and take 40 girls. So in the end, it was worse than a zero sum. It was actually doing more damage in trying to get girls. So you know, after 3 months up there, I resolved the only way is to expose the sponsors of Boko Haram, the big men. Who funds it? And followed the money trail. I found out who the key arms supplier was from another country, how the money was getting to him, the whole lot. These guys were so powerful, the sponsors of Boko Haram, they were untouchable.
What, military figures in neighbouring countries?
There's both, in Nigeria and in neighbouring countries. People at the very top of the political tree and the power structure.
Supporting Boko Haram. We're talking about Chad, Cameroon.
Chad and Cameroon, there was clear evidence of camps in both those countries. The leadership in Chad was complicit. When it comes to Cameroon, I think not so much the president there, he was having trouble controlling the very north of the country.
You see, this is the thing, Stephen. This is the kind of, when we look at problems like this, like there was a massive public campaign to support the release of these girls, these poor girls, international campaign.
Sure.
And the understanding behind it, as I recall, was that these girls have been taken by Boko Haram, whose name means Western education is forbidden. These are extremists who are opposed to the education of girls and women. But what you're saying here, it's really a kind of deathlessly cynical operation, a kind of a trade in hostages, really, that's being run by military figures in neighbouring countries, and these are their local intermediaries, their stooges. This is a really very cynical thing that's going on here.
Well, it's two sides of the one coin, if I might put it like this. The purists among the Izala movement, well, I would say that their goal was religion and political action was a mechanism. The other side of the coin was politics is the aim, boys, and religion is the mechanism we'll use. So what I found was, in the northeast, a guy who wanted to be governor in 2003 used a local gang and armed them heavily, which became the forerunner of Boko Haram, to strong-arm his opponents, and he won governorship. He did the same in 2007, and it got bigger and bigger, and it mutated. He wanted to be president. He is now, and I have said his name on the world media, and he's done his bit to try and bring me apart. But the evidence, I think, is overwhelming, but he is now the leader of the opposition, the main opposition party in Nigeria. Untouchable. Doesn't matter how much evidence you've got. I think this is a part of what we don't yet understand. You know, these countries haven't had 100 years of democracy or 50 years of democracy. These countries are mostly out of military dictatorships. We're not even one generation out of it. All the trappings of democracy that are embedded in our society haven't started to take root there yet. And they're very fragile.
So after all of that, Stephen, despite all this kind of goodwill and energy and experience and knowledge and contacts and even your preparedness to hand over your own money, were you able to rescue any of these girls?
Well, in the end, we had a handover of 60 girls, one hit. And again, a friend, a very prominent Nigerian, he was able to arrange the major state hospital to lay on a medical bus. We had IVs, doctors, nurses, the whole works. And we got the call. The girls were all to be left at this village, and then we were to go there and pick them up, give the guys the time to all disappear. And just within minutes of getting there, someone else got there and grabbed all the girls. And it was because the police force had offered a gigantic reward for the girls that very morning.
So the reward got in your way.
That's right. That night I was talking to them about it, the leaders on the phone, and they said, yes, we know who did that. We've taken care of them. But I was still left with the problem. The girls then were now over the border in another country. This was the sort of thing that kept happening.
Were you overwhelmed with a kind of sense of the futility of this?
I think I got to that stage, and that's why I went to London and named some of the sponsors publicly, because I realised there wasn't any other way. And now, right now, there would be around 10,000 women and girls who've been kidnapped and are in that same situation. And it just so happens, if you're a Chibok girl, okay, it's like the 20 that were given up recently, and they will be looked after. But before that, girls who had managed to escape from Boko Haram camps, these were girls who'd been raped repeatedly, often had a child by Boko Haram, could never be married. Their families didn't want to see them.
Well, seen as damaged goods, were they?
Oh, absolutely, for the rest of their lives. So when you rescue girls out of there, that's just the start. How do you provide a new life for them? And so these girls are basically the girls who've been able to escape, and ones that we've helped escape. You wonder whether their situation after the escape is any better than having been left in the Boko Haram camp. So really they need to be, whether it's taken out of there or to another town and, you know, almost rehabilitated the with trauma counselling, start a new life. And they're really, really lovely young women, terribly traumatised, and some of them are so courageous to tell their stories.
So is that it? Are you done with Nigeria now?
Oh, no, you always dabble. You can't sort of walk away from it.
See, this is what I'm struck by, this terrible thing you're describing here. It's there's something so completely nightmarish about this situation you're describing. You seem to speak about Nigeria with affection, actually. It's a funny thing.
Oh, it's people. I found the people who have the least are probably the most giving of the lot. And trust. And as I say, these young women telling their stories is just heart-wrenching stuff. We would like to go back and do more. I have a bit of a boxing match with cancer these days, and it means I can't travel like I used to. But what we need is a proper charitable institution who can take these young women and give them the counselling, rehabilitate them. A rescue is just the start.
What an amazing story. Come back on the show again in a couple of years and give us an update, please, Stan. What an extraordinary story you have to tell. I really appreciate you telling it, and thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's former consultant and advisor to several Nigerian presidents, Stephen Davis. And I spoke to Stephen in 2017. And since we last spoke, another 104 schoolgirls have been kidnapped by Boko Haram. 100 of them have been returned, but 4 are still missing. abc.net.au/conversations is our website. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.